Have you finished your income tax returns yet? Probably, if you're like most people, no. Maybe if you had, you thought you had some money coming back, you might have already done it. We did our income taxes, completed those over the weekend, Renee and I, and glad to have that out of the way. But for a lot of people, that has that little task is yet to come. Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey, back with us once again to help you deal with your income tax returns. And certainly if you have some questions for Steve, he's always happy to answer them. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, at 263-1890. The phones tend to get busy when Steve's on, so probably best to call sooner rather than later. Steve, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Great, and thanks for coming in on this very busy time, I know, for you.
My pleasure.
Well, I tell you what, we have callers online already. I'm going to ask one question, and that relates to the alternative minimum tax. There were some changes that went into effect in 2006. I think they raised the
exemption amount. When you compute the alternative minimum tax, you start off with your regular taxable income. Then you add back things like your personal exemptions. You lose your tax deductions, so you add those back for real estate taxes and Wisconsin income tax. And you can, and then there's other adjustments for certain people depending upon what you own and what you have. Then you come to a subtotal, and then you get to subtract from that an exemption amount. And that exemption amount was increased for 2006. For example, in the joint return, I believe it was increased from $58,000 to $62,550. So, but that exemption amount gets phased out if your that income number, that tentative income number, is more than $150,000. So if your income is not too high, that additional exemption amount will clearly help you out. If your income is above $400,000, that exemption amount gets phased out anyway and doesn't do you any good. So it depends.
On where you are.
Well, that's right.
On the income scale. Well, it'd be nice to be in those upper
that's
income
right.
scales.
That's right, exactly.
Jim and Wausau, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm interested in whether or not any of the costs associated with an assisted living facility would be deductible as medical expenses. I've read publication 502, but assisted living doesn't show up either in the list of clearly deductible expenses or clearly not.
Right. And, it needs to be for medical care. And it's possible some assisted living facilities really provide very little and in the terms of medical care, and there may be nothing. Others, there may be nurses on staff that provide a certain type of assistance along those lines. And then if they do, the charges for those types of services would be deductible as medical expenses. So you need to take a look at what is being provided and to see if that meets the definition of a medical expense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck, Jim. Thanks very much. So in other words, there may be a situation where it would be 100%, but that would be if the person was really being totally cared for.
Like if you're in a nursing home, you're likely all the expenses there, relating right. to the nursing home and nursing care and medications will probably all be eligible to be treated as a medical expense deduction.
Okay. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Steve in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Steve.
Morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I have another one of these, alternative minimum tax things in relationship to a conversion from a regular IRA to a Roth. I guess all that money becomes what, ordinary income?
Yes.
Is that how that works? Okay. And then you just pay your tax on it. Well, I'm using a software program, and I hope they did it right. I didn't hit the AMT thing. I'm about $1,000 short because I had to pay so much on the conversion anyway.
Yes, and that kind of makes sense because your adjusted gross income has to be under $100,000 to do a conversion from a regular IRA to a Roth. And at lower income levels, you usually don't have an alternative minimum tax problem. On a married filing joint return, you're probably, if you have $150,000 of income or so, and then some qualifying dividends and a fair amount of real estate taxes and Wisconsin income taxes, you're likely to have a problem. But at lower incomes, not a problem.
Okay.
Because I want to do this again next year. We're still trying to roll.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, just a little bit. I don't want to get too high. According to the software, my actual tax is like 16.9% or something. Whatever they, is that marginal tax? Whatever
that would be.
I
would guess that would be an average rate, probably.
Yeah, okay,
average
rate
would probably be higher.
Right. Okay.
All right. So if I can just mention one thing for other listeners, there is probably many of our listeners that can't convert their traditional IRAs to a Roth because their income is higher than $100,000. In one of the tax bills last year, Congress added a provision starting in 2010, in the year 2010, you can convert to a Roth IRA, your other traditional IRAs, even if your income is higher than $100,000. Plus, they'll give you a two-year spread of the taxable income. So many people haven't done traditional non-deductible IRAs because there might be more vehicles that had more flexibility on you timing your receipt of income and so forth. But now, if you don't have substantial traditional balances in IRAs, to do a non-deductible traditional IRA contribution now with the objective in 2010 to convert it to a Roth, it lets people who are otherwise ineligible for a Roth get to a Roth in 2010.
Oh.
So I mentioned you can't do a Roth conversion if your income is higher than 100. On a married filing joint return, you can't do a Roth contribution if your adjusted gross income is more than $160,000. So there's a little planning opportunity for middle-income America.
Let's go to Nancy in Wausau next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am in the process of building a small, energy-efficient home, and I wanted to be prepared for next year when I fill out my taxes. I got low E windows and a furnace, high-efficiency furnace, and insulation, and I wanted to know, like, I have a builder that's building. Do I need to get, like, a statement from him that he installed those, or what do I need? Because I normally do my own taxes, because I assume, and maybe you can correct me, that I am eligible for some energy tax credits.
Sure. Let me just give you a form reference first. And it's form 5695, and if you get that form and the related instructions, it has a good description of what all is eligible, and you'll need to file that form with your 2007 tax return. Obviously, that applies for 2006, too, for people that had expenditures in 2006. Basically, you'll see those instructions, and they describe to you what is eligible, and usually there'll just be a certification by the manufacturer that it meets the qualifications as being energy-eligible property. I'll just give you a quick rundown of the items that are available for the energy credit. There's a 10% credit for the cost of new materials for energy efficiency improvements to the outside of a building, which includes insulation, caulking, exterior windows, exterior doors, and then certain metal roofs, which we usually don't see around our part of the country. But that's just materials. And then there's also, and that's a 10% credit, there's also a 100% credit for the cost of new materials and labor for residential energy property expenditures. And that's such thing as fuel efficient or efficient furnaces, air conditioners, heat pumps, certain fans, water heaters. Okay? There you get 100% of the cost of the materials and labor. Both of these credits, though, are limited to a total of $500. So, and then there's some sub-limitations. For example, windows, your maximum credit is $200. So only $2,000 of windows is going to qualify. But so it's kind of a convoluted calculation, and there are different minimums. But that's a quick overview of how the new energy credit works.
And there go ahead.
That would work for new construction.
Yes, it does. It does work for new construction.
We actually, in our figuring our taxes, we got some credits for, we put a new energy efficient furnace in, and so we got credit for that. So, and one other thing too, which I'm forgetting right at the moment, but, you know, every little bit helps.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Yeah. Did you have to save your like receipts for your or your invoice for your furnace to submit with your taxes?
We had it, and that was helpful because you need to give them the exact amount of the cost of purchase.
Okay. Sure.
Okay.
And anything when it comes to the tax world, you should save anything from a deduction perspective or a credit perspective for 3 years federal or 4 years Wisconsin, because if you're audited, they may request you to provide that documentation. And if you don't have the documentation, they may disallow the deduction or credit.
Well, thank you very much. I'll let another caller come in, but I'll go pick up that form.
Excellent.
All right. Thanks.
IRS.gov has forms, and so print the 5695 and the related instructions, and you'll be well-versed.
Just one other aside, there were in several parts of Wisconsin, there was hail damage and wind damage and so forth to homes, and we actually got a little credit on that based on the amount of money we received for fixing our home from the insurance company and the actual cost of
replacement. So you received the insurance proceeds, and then you used the proceeds to buy some energy-efficient property and got some credit on that.
We got some credit on
nice.
That. So that worked out pretty well.
I remember that well. That was April 13th last year.
Yes. Yes, it was. Fred in New Berlin, it's your turn now. Hi, Fred.
Hi, good morning. My wife is listening on the other phone, too. But here's my question. We've got a check for a class action suit for a humongous amount of $26. But the check was issued on December 27th, and we received it on January 3rd, 07. And my question is, do we consider that for 206 taxes or 207, and where do we put it on our taxes?
Okay, you're a cash method taxpayer, and your actual receipt is when you would pay tax on it, not when the check was written. Since the dollar amount is so small, if the paying entity does any 1099 type reporting, I would just be consistent with that. But assuming you don't get a 1099 of any form,
gotten any yet.
Okay, then I would. The actual receipt is the proper year in which to report it.
What do you mean the receipt?
When you receive the check.
When we receive the check.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
So what
would be.
What proof do you have of that?
Well, if they mail, you know, your word is as good as gold, particularly on $27. I don't think anybody's going to question you on that. Mm-hmm. As far as how to report it, it depends upon the nature of the recovery, and you should take a look at. You know, the documentation to see if there's any explanation. A lot of times in a class action suit, they're arguing that there were actions taken inappropriately that diminished the value of your stock. So oftentimes there's a good argument that it's either a reduction in the basis of your stock if you continue to hold it or if you sold it to treat it as capital gain. But sometimes there's also some interest amounts that may need to be reported as ordinary income. So just take a look at the documentation to see if it gives you any guidance. But
all right. Thanks a lot for calling, Fred. Appreciate it. Steve Schmidt, our guest, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. Talking Taxes with Steve. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Taxes with Steve Schmidt of RSM McGladrey. Glad to have you listening in. Larry Mueller here. We'll go right back to the phones and to Tom in Oregon next. Tom, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I've always done my own taxes and had no problem with the IRS on them, even though I do Schedule C and a couple of other complicated things. But the last couple of years, they've been encouraging us to use the commercial programs, and this year the state doesn't even have its own program. They've also gone to the commercial ones. But I've had problems with these, and I wonder what guarantees there are in using them. Last year I tried one, and there was a flaw in the program. They ultimately refunded my money, so I just gave up on it. This year I used one of the major ones again and was amazed to find how much they thought I owed. And I then checked myself, and I found that they were charging me $1,000 more for tax than I actually owed.
Wow.
And I'm wondering what recourse we have for this. They say they'll guarantee that if the IRS penalizes us, they will cover the penalty. But what happens if the error is in the other way?
You know, there's a couple of packages out there that I've heard are pretty good. Obviously, we use professional tax preparation software, but Tax Cut is one, and the
TurboTax
is the other one. And people I've talked to generally say that those programs seem to work pretty well. You know, we've got a complicated tax system, and if you get a code in wrong or something like that, it's possible that the program is still programmed properly, but maybe you've coded something improperly, the wrong line, the wrong box, the wrong code or whatever, however they base their calculations on. So go back and carefully look at you know, what the input parameters are. And if it's still wrong, then I'd go back to the company and let them know that they've got some calculation errors. And maybe they have a help support person that can help you. You know, oftentimes we think a computer program is wrong, but sometimes it's us users as well. Mm-hmm. And but that's about all I can tell you.
I'd sure go back to the company.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Kathy and Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I have a question. We placed a conservation easement on our property, and we had it appraised to see what the change in value was due to the easement. We have, know that we have to fill out a form. I think it's 8283 or something like that.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. But my question is, in filling out the taxes, how does that affect the adjusted minimum income, and where would you put this on the tax form?
Okay. Charitable contributions are deductible on Schedule A of Form 1040. That's the itemized deduction schedule. As you pointed out, if you have non-cash contributions that exceed $500 or, in certain cases, $5,000, you need to complete IRS Form 8283 and then attach that to your tax return. Fortunately for you, charitable contributions do not present an alternative minimum tax problem. They are deductible both for the regular tax and the alternative minimum tax. And you'll see when you get Form 6251, you start that form either with taxable income or your taxable income before deducting personal exemptions, and you'll see there is no add-back for charitable contributions, which means they are deductible. Mm. So contributions do not present an alternative minimum tax issue.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah. The other thing is, I know that there was a change in the tax law that allows you to, it increases the percentage of your income that you can deduct, and then it allows you to stretch that over for 15 years in 2006 and 2007. When it says stretch it out over 15 years, you decide how much you want to deduct each year or use each year?
I'm not sure I'm with you on that one. What, are you talking about contributions or something else?
No, in conservation easements, there mm-hmm. was a tax change in tax law last year that allows a change for 2006 and 2007 in terms of what you can deduct.
Yeah, okay. And there was a change that if you do multiple contributions that would relate back to the original. But I haven't applied that provision, so.
This is especially relates to conservation easements.
Right. Okay.
Just conservation easements. Okay. Well, so that one you're not.
No, I have not dealt with that issue.
I think if you go on the Land Trust Alliance website, it has some information on that. If you wanted to check that out. But thank you very much for the other. Mm-hmm. That's very helpful.
Sure. Thanks for calling, Kathy. And we'll turn to Scott in La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I probably was suffering from false memory syndrome, but last summer I would have bet money that I had sold some e-bonds. You know, I'd looked them up and found out what the interest was and went ahead and filed my taxes and put down that I'd sold this e-bonds. And so I never got a 1099 from the bank, but I'd never sold bonds before, so I didn't know. So I thought, well, okay, so they didn't send it to me. I'll look them up. I'll find out what it was when I sold them, what the interest amount was. So now I filed that and I put in the interest. So it's like, you know, $1,300 or something that I put down in interest that was accrued on the bonds, but that I didn't actually owe at that moment. And my question is, what should I do? Should I file an amended return? That's what you'd go with?
Sure.
Okay. And what is there a specific form that I would use to do that?
Yes. The federal form is 1040X, and the Wisconsin form is 1X.
Okay, now do I, since there's no...
Oh, actually, Wisconsin, you wouldn't pay tax on U.S. interest. So if you did the return properly, there'd be no change to the Wisconsin taxable income.
Okay, so, yeah, because my quandary, and I know this, I might be kind of, you know, this might be a little esoteric as a call, but my quandary was, I'm thinking maybe I'd sell them this year, and if I went ahead and did that, then I would have, I still would owe that interest, and I just wondered if there was any way I would apply from the past or how that works.
Well, what will happen is you'll get a 1099 in 2007 showing you have the interest, and then if you don't report it, the IRS will send you a matching notice saying the bank said you received $1,300 of U.S. Treasury interest in 2007. You didn't report anything on your return, and we're going to increase your tax liability by this. If this is not right, write us back and let us know where we're wrong.
So you're better off to do the amended form.
Right.
And then just take it this year then, whatever
yeah.
happens.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Good luck, Scott. Kathy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Here. I am so happy you are there to answer my question. I have a 27-year-old son who's been a grad student who's accrued a lot of student loans. Last year, we were able to help him pay some of that off, and we wanted to know how we can claim that as a gift to him, or how do we do that?
Well, the student loans are his loans or your loans?
No, they're his loans.
They're his loans. Then he would need to deduct the interest. Within the limits, you can deduct up to $2,500 of interest on the form 1040, unless income goes beyond certain levels, in which case it either gets phased out or is eliminated. But then what you pay to him really is a gift to him.
Right.
And then he would deduct his interest on his return.
Okay. But how do I deduct the gift that we gave him?
No. Gifts to people are not deductible.
Oh.
So... You can tell him that he should give you that portion of the money.
Yeah, he could gift you his tax savings back. Huh?
All right, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call if you want to join in, or in Madison at 263-1890. We have a couple of open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast. Karen and Yuba, you're next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I wondered if you contribute money, if you do a gift or a donation to a charitable organization and it's tax deductible, but you don't itemize, you just use the standard deduction.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then what happens to that charitable gift, that deduction? I mean,
it's already incorporated in your standard deduction, so it saves you nothing. And there has been some talk to allow non-itemizers to deduct a limited amount of charitable contributions against your income, but that is not currently in our tax law. So if you do not itemize, there is no deduction for you, contribution.
So you need to try it out and itemize and see if it exceeds the standard deduction.
And what some people do is they try to bunch their deductions every other year. They'll pay their contributions every other year. They'll try to time their real estate taxes so they're paid every other year. You can even do that with your Wisconsin income tax. You can pay them during the year 1 year, and then you can prepay for the next year and not have withholding. The Wisconsin Department of Revenue will give you a certificate that you can provide your employer to not have withholding if you prepay your tax. So if you're kind of in the range where you don't have a lot of itemized deductions, try bunching them, and then you'll get some benefit every other year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, my uncle did that TurboTax.
Yes.
And then my aunt made him take the tax return to an accountant.
Yes.
And the accountant was able to reduce their taxes $2,000
from
TurboTax. So they aren't using TurboTax money anymore.
Right. And you know, it's not that the program may not be correct. It's just that the accountant, the professional, may have helped the taxpayers identify tax planning issues or deductions that weren't thought of when TurboTax was used. I mean, I can think of a really simple one. You had a tax due on your last year's Wisconsin return of $5,000, and you forgot to put it in TurboTax this year. Well, TurboTax isn't going to give you the deduction, but if the professional preparer, of course, they would spot that things, or if there's contribution carryovers or capital loss carryovers. Mm-hmm. There's a whole host of things. I mean, we really do have a convoluted, complex tax law, And, you know, certain simple situations, a pay professional probably can't save you any money. Mm-hmm. But if you have a few things going on, it's you know, sometimes paying the fees is well worth
well
it.
Well worth it, you bet.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Terry in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. I was going to take my taxes somewhere, and I thought, no, I'll do this again, and I don't know why. I have two children in college, and you used to be able to take, like, the tuition expenses and that kind of thing right out. It was in the adjusted income area on the 1040. That's not there anymore. And our expenses were not, there were no loans, so it wasn't interest. And the money did not come out of like a tax sheltered account for that. So as I started looking, they have the lifetime learning credits and hope credits. Is that what I should be looking at?
Well, let me help you out. You're right. You don't see the tuition deduction on page one of Form 1040 any longer.
Yeah.
But about Christmas time, a new tax bill, an extender's bill, was passed. And in fact, you are eligible for a tuition deduction in 2006, very similar to what you were eligible to or for in 2005.
Okay.
And basically, if your income is under certain thresholds, your maximum amount is $4,000 for tuition and fees. And if you have a little bit higher income, the maximum amount is $2,000. So it works just like it did for 2005 on your federal return.
Right.
And so if you probably go to IRS.gov and put in tuition deduction, I would expect it'll bring an announcement up that will explain that. What you actually do is on your Form 1040, you claim the tuition deduction on line 35, and the preprinted text on the form says domestic production activities deduction.
Yes. Okay.
But what you do then is you just pencil in a T to the left of the box 35, and that stands that you're claiming the tuition deduction, and that'll, you know, tip the IRS off that that's what you're deducting there. And so what you should do, though, is to see whether you're better off claiming the tuition deduction or one of the two education credits, the HOPE credit or the lifetime learning credit.
So basically just do the little you know, worksheets on both of those credits. What is the difference between those? Can I only use, like, the lifetime, is that a one-time?
Well, the HOPE credit is a limited credit, and it went up a little bit in 2006 from 2005. But you can only claim that 2 years, two tax years.
All right.
And it has to be in the first 2 years of college. So it can be your freshman year, the stub period, the half year. It can be the freshman sophomore year or the sophomore junior year. Those all would be eligible years. But you can only claim it in 2 years.
Oh.
And then the other credit is a lifetime learning credit, which is 20% of $2,000. I'm sorry, of $10,000. So the maximum credit you can claim in your lifetime on that is $2,000.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So get the form, I believe it's 8863, and
yes,
go through the calculations.
All right. Good luck, Terry.
I'll tell you, I did go on the IRS .gov,
yes,
and they had last year's information on both of those credits, and there was, it did, in a couple places it said, and legislative pending,
yes,
blah, 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 and it had nothing new, nothing.
Oh,
and
really?
This was a week ago.
Oh, I'm surprised at that. But no, it's clearly there. So if you have 2005 instructions, read what they say about the tuition deduction. It'll probably get you the right answer here for 2006.
All right. Good luck. Thanks, Terry. Nancy in Oshkosh, hi to you.
My question is about the qualified charitable deduction that people can make from IRAs directly to a charitable organization. I know how it's handled on the federal tax level. You put zero on line 15B. What happens to it when you come to the state level? Do they want you to add it back?
Yes, you need to do two things. Wisconsin doesn't recognize the qualifying charitable deduction by you know, an IRA contribution that goes directly from the IRA to the charity if you're over age 70 and a half. So what you need to do is include the distribution in Wisconsin income on Schedule I, and then you also need to increase your charitable contributions for
right.
the itemized deduction credit.
Right.
And so you lose a little bit on the Wisconsin return because you pay tax on the income at 6.75%, mm-hmm. but your itemized deduction credit rate is only 5%.
Right. I knew they wouldn't like that.
Yes.
Okay.
But there is no special line that they always have numbers for all these changes you make for the state. Is there a particular number for that?
Well, a Schedule I is what you would
Schedule
use.
Schedule I?
Yes.
Yeah. You have to file the I?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Bob in Cassville, it's your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. A little bit of a esoteric question, I'm afraid. I have purchased some things that are collectible and have appreciated in value rather significantly. They are not protected. They're not under any of the lower cost capital gains things. It'll be the full 28%. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Canadian citizen living in the States, and I can export those things to Canada and just pay the 7% import duty on their total value when I bring them into Canada and then sell them in Canada with the basis for capital gains being the amount that I declared when I crossed the border. The question is the American government going to have heartburn about the fact that they're not getting their capital gains on these things that I bought in America?
Well, you said you're a Canadian citizen.
That's correct.
Are you a resident of Canada as well?
Not currently.
You're a resident in Wisconsin, in the U.S.?
That's correct, yeah.
Because when you're, if you're a non-resident alien, which it sounds like you are, you're a resident alien.
Yes.
You're an alien, but you're resident in the States.
Yeah.
The States taxes your worldwide income, regardless of where the sale originates. It's just like a citizen.
Okay.
So if you're a resident of the U.S., you're taxed just like I am.
Okay. I thought there was some kind of agreement between the American and the Canadian governments that you only had to pay tax once on income, and if you paid...
Well, there may be treaty provisions, and you always need to take a look at any treaty provisions that might reduce tax liabilities. But if there is, I'm not familiar with what the Canadian one would be, but you need to find the protocol and then find the provision that would allow you to do that. But I don't know that off the top of my head. You know, I have some international people that I could call on in our firm if I had that issue myself. But I don't know the treaty provisions off the top of my head.
All right.
So I should talk to somebody that does international tax?
Yes, right. See if there might be a treaty provision that would reduce your tax on that. But I'm not
Thank
aware
you.
Of it off the top
right.
of my head.
Thanks for calling. And Beth in Pleasant Prairie, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I had a question about a return that I'm doing from moving from Michigan to Wisconsin. I'm doing a Michigan state return and a Wisconsin state return. And my mortgage interest, we sold the home in Michigan and we bought a home in Wisconsin. And my mortgage interest on both of those properties, do I separate them and put them on each return? Like the Michigan mortgage interest on the Michigan return and the Wisconsin interest on the Wisconsin return?
That's what you do with the income side. That's clear. Usually on the deduction side, they'll just take, Wisconsin does, they take your total eligible itemized deduction or credit in your case, and then
right.
they'll prorate it based on the Wisconsin income to the total income on Form 1 NPR.
Okay.
I can't speak to what Michigan does because I just don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, in the TurboTax program that I was using, it said if you have a second home outside of Wisconsin, that the mortgage would have to be excluded.
Yes. For example, let's say you're a full-year Wisconsin resident and you pay $10,000 on your home and resident.
Michigan. I didn't understand if
right.
that was second home.
But you're,
like I had another home that I sold,
yeah.
but that was my primary residence.
Yeah, your Michigan residents.
I could still count that.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck, Beth. Thank you. Babette, in Madison, your turn now. Hi.
Hi. I'm self-employed, and I have two offices, one where I do my work, and then at home, my office I use for my computer and the book work. So I file a 1040, and for expenses for business use of home, my business percentage is 18. Now, my question is, when I fill out my other forms, which are self-employment, profits, or loss from business.
That's a Schedule C. Mm-hmm.
Right. This is what I'm blanking on because I've been doing my own taxes for years, but don't I do 82% because there's something about 82%.
What you do is fill out Form 8829.
Right.
And then what that does is it properly prorates the expenses to the business schedule and the non-business portion. Then the business part will go to Schedule C. There's a line towards the bottom of Schedule
right.
C for
I filled
the
it out.
And that's where the 18% would go. And then the 82% of the real estate taxes and the interest, which are deductible whether or not you're in a business, they're itemized deductions. The 82% for those items you take to Schedule A if you itemize your deductions. So that's what you do with the 82%.
I don't have a Schedule A.
If you don't itemize, then that's fine. There's nothing more you do with it.
You don't do anything else with it.
You just take the 18% to the Schedule C, and that's the end of it.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling. And Jack in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi there. I don't have a tax problem, but I'd like to get back to this question about the e-bond tax that the gentleman brought up a little while ago. We want to caution him to be sure to file for the refund on that tax that he paid in the too early year so that he doesn't get barred from claiming that, thinking of it as just a washout that, oh, that's okay, I paid too much then, and it'll offset because it might not offset. He might be required to pay the tax on the year that it's really due for while he can no longer collect the refund because it becomes a barred year.
That's good advice, and I think we told the caller probably you should amend. There's also mitigation provisions that might hold the year open. If you report income in the wrong year, there actually is a provision. They're called the mitigation provisions that actually would open a closed year, likely for this purpose. But that's getting probably a little too technical for this program. But there are some special provisions. If you report something in the wrong year or deduct something in the wrong year, there are provisions that can open those years both for the IRS and the taxpayers, beyond the normal 3-year statute of limitations.
Thanks, Jack, for calling. Appreciate it. Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. With us today, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking taxes today with Steve Schmidt of RSM McGladrey. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Mark in Madison, you're next. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. In 06, we moved from the East Coast to Madison, Wisconsin, and got caught in this real estate market so that we now own a home out there on the East Coast. Fortunately, we were able to rent this home, and I'm wondering how I deal with the rental income balanced against our payments and taxes and that part of
it. It's a good question. I suppose there's a threshold question whether it's a personal use property and you're just renting it to mitigate holding costs or whether you've really converted it to legitimate profit-making rental income. And the significance of the difference is if there's a loss, if you've converted it to legitimate rental property, the loss would be deductible on the rental, where if not, it kind of comes under the hobby loss rules and wouldn't be. So it's a matter of properly interpreting what you've done with respect to the residents.
I see. But as far as claiming the income and writing off the expenses, a basic business.
Yeah, well, you would use Schedule E. Schedule E on the for the Form 1040. Is a rental income and expense schedule where you list for each property the rent income and then all the expenses relating to that property, including depreciation. And then the net income becomes taxable if there's a loss. You're going to be subject to the passive activity loss rules. You'll need to get Form 8582, read through those instructions to see if the loss is currently deductible. And it depends upon whether you actively manage the property or not, and then whether your income is beyond certain thresholds.
All right.
Is this a fairly complicated process? I do my own taxes on a regular basis. Is this something that you would recommend professional help on?
I think, yes. You probably have some judgment issues based on your particular facts. And if it turns out to be a rental loss, there are passive activity loss rules that need to be dealt with, which, unless you're real interested in boning up on those issues, it might be worth paying some professional fees to get some help with that.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot.
All right. I suppose another consideration for you is you know, you want to keep it as your principal residence. You got to have it for 2 out of 5 years to get the gain exclusion. So you want to, if you're renting it, you want to be careful you don't go too long and not be able to use the gain exclusion provision if you have some significant gain on the old home out east.
Mm. All right. Thanks again for calling. Roy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Roy.
Hi, thank you. I have an investment in Series E bonds from a house I sold about 20, my wife and I sold about 25 years ago, and have accumulated quite a bit of deferred interest on that. And I'm wondering, we're in the late 70s now, how to change the, if it's worthwhile changing the beneficiaries, maybe the grandchildren, or if it's, if, would it make sense to start taking some withdrawals out now? We sort of have a hedge, as I see it, against increasing interest rates, because it protects us against the fall in principal, and we can also get a minimum interest rate of 4%. And how, so I'm worried about how to change, should we change the beneficiaries? Because I'm worried if we die, we're, that we have a huge taxable event.
Sure. I guess it sounds like you have some old Series E bonds. One thing I would check to make sure that none of them have hit their final maturity.
No, that's true. I got about 10 years ago on that.
Okay, so you're all right there.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
So you're still earning interest. And if you're retired and you don't have substantial income, you might want to start cashing some each year, because if you're in your retirement years and have more limited income than your heirs might, that interest will always be taxed to somebody.
Yeah. What if I made the grandchildren the successor beneficiary?
Well, there's a problem with there's a kiddie tax, which now applies if a child is under age 18. It used to be 14, but now it's 18,
mm-hmm.
and they have more than like $1,700 of income. They're actually taxed at the parent's rate. So I think within the family, the thing to do is compare your marginal tax rate each year to what you anticipate your children's are or will be at the time the interest would be paid out. And if you find your rate lower, you might do well to cash some in each year to take advantage of a lower rate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, okay, well, that's wondering about. What about the wording? I think that answers that question, too.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Roy. And Greg in La Crosse, it's your turn next. Hi, Greg.
Hey. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little bit of a variation or spin on an earlier question. I'm a parent of a dependent college student that has graduated, and we've been, both of us have been making loan payments, including interest. I happen to also be a co-borrower on some of the loans because they're alternative school loans.
Mm-hmm.
But then also there are payments being made on federally on Stafford, Perk, and Ford loans, too. So I was of the understanding that since he's dependent and since I am a co-borrower on some of these loans, that student loan interest is deductible on my tax form. Is that correct?
I would want to check the instructions on that. And, if you're liable on the debt, then you're usually entitled to deduct the interest. It has to be your interest, your debt. So as a co-obligor, I would think you're right, but I just would want to check myself on that. And but if you go to the IRS instructions for 1040 line 33, I think it is, the instructions there will contain some commentary on that. I just don't remember what all the detail is off the top of my head.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Tim in Wausau next. Tim, hello to you.
Hi, Larry and Steve. I am the personal rep for my mom's estate, and I found out recently from the IRS that I need to submit a 2004 return. And I was told what I need to submit is a Schedule D and a Form 1040. a Schedule D for some stocks that were sold. And I'm wondering, in terms of tracking down all of the information for this, do I need to submit the actual end-of-year tax statements that were sent out in 2004? Or am I, if I know the amounts that my mom received, can I simply state those on the return?
Yes. And, of course, in the year of death, you need to properly prorate for the things that were received on or before death and what was received after death. And you only report on the Form 1040 property that was sold or interest and dividends received before death. But you just simply need to list those on the tax return. You don't need to submit all the 1099s and so forth.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And Dale in La Crosse. Hello to you.
Hello. Calling about the, I think it's the alternative minimum tax issue.
Yes.
I have, I'm retired. I have Social Security, a pension, and then I have some variable annuities. So sometimes the income fluctuates. And how does one know if you get into that problem of the minimum tax issue?
You simply need to complete Form 6251 and see whether it applies or not. The IRS has a worksheet somewhere. It's probably on irs.gov or somewhere in the 1040 package that if you can complete that, it kind of is an indicator whether you will have a problem or not.
Okay.
But the surest way is just to get Form 6251.
Okay.
And go through the number crunching.
But is this something that can kind of all of a sudden happen quickly or sneak up on a person?
Well, it's as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, if your incomes go beyond the, for example, on a joint return, $150,000, then the exemption amount starts phasing out and there's a greater probability that you'll have alternative minimum tax. If you have higher real estate taxes or Wisconsin income taxes, that may cause a problem. Another thing that causes a problem is long-term capital gains or qualifying dividends that are eligible for the 15% rate. All the more you have of those items, the more likely you'll be subject to the alternative minimum tax. And what we do when we prepare returns, we go through the alternative minimum tax calculation on everyone to see whether it applies.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah. I want to go back to the student loan question. I did just open the IRS instructions for line 33, and here's qualified student loan. It says a qualified student loan is any loan you took out to pay the qualified higher education expenses for yourself and your spouse, any person who was your dependent when the loan was taken out. So if the loan was taken out for a child when he was a dependent or she was a dependent, you're good. Or any person you could have claimed as a dependent for the year the loan was taken out, except that, and there's some exceptions. But so borrowing for a dependent seems to get you that interest deduction. But that's right in the instructions for line 33.
Arnie and Shano, it's your turn. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I've got a farm that has a utility line across it, and they're changing it. And they came through last summer, and they had the easement papers, and they gave me some money for the easement for either 100 years or for perpetuity. And it's business-type property because it's a farm.
Okay.
And I know my basis. Is that just a long-term capital gain? I've had the property 20 years.
Well, I would also, before you report as capital gain, to see if there's a good position that you might be able to reduce the basis in your property.
Well, it's probably worth less. A lot of people don't like
300,000
volt.
So you've got an impairment to the value of your property, and I think you would find some authorities out there that, assuming you have adequate basis, that you might be able to reduce the basis in your land and not have to report it as gain this year. But that's one I'd want to check. But I think over the years I've had situations where those types of recoveries. We've been able to reduce land basis rather than report it as gain, at least in part. So,
have you been able to do it for the entire piece of property then?
Well, yes. Well, it's for the property. Well, for the property that's been impaired, which might be a contiguous property. But you'd want to take a look at those rules. But I think you're going to find some ability to reduce basis. Mm-hmm.
Does a person go to a tax specialist then, such as yourself?
Sure.
It's kind of a judgment call?
Well, actually, you know, we don't. Not all of us deal with all these issues all the time. And, you know, so sometimes you just need to open a book and refresh your memory once in a while on some of the issues. And And that's where a professional comes in. They have access to the research tools to take your particular facts, see what the authorities are, and then apply them to your situation.
Okay, mm-hmm. So I'd need some help on that, it sounds like.
Sure.
I've
got one other quick one. Can I throw it at you?
Sure.
I had a casualty loss. A storm took out a boathouse that I had, and I talked to the IRS that it is a deductible casualty according to that 4684 or whatever.
Right.
And as I work myself through it, I see that you have to use a basis. The property cost about $10,000 like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's $30,000 to replace it. It appears I have to take that differential $20,000 loss and just use my 10%, just use the $10,000 original basis cost for it, even though it's going to cost me $30,000 to replace it.
Are you rebuilding or not rebuilding?
Well, I want to rebuild it, and that's where I got the $30,000 price. I got a quote to replace the structure as it was.
Is this business use property or just personal use?
Personal use.
It's just personal use. So, so you had, okay.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a break. We'll ponder that.
Okay.
We'll ponder that issue, Arnie.
We're at the top of the hour. Okay.
And we'll be back with our guest, Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director of the Madison office of RSM McGladrey.
The website.
Glad to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking your taxes today with Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Steve, we had an email question come in about filing status for a gentleman's mother. He's her son, doing her taxes. She's 72. Her husband passed away in April of 2005, and her mentally ill son passed away in February of 2006. Her son was on SSI and passed away at age 45. And he states, as I read the rules, she would qualify as a widower, and her son would also qualify as an exemption. If there are any other considerations, please also advise.
I would agree with his analysis. If you have a married person and one spouse dies and there's qualifying children as dependents for the succeeding 2 years, you can file really as a joint qualifying widower. You get the joint rates rather than single rates or head of household rates, which will save some tax. Also, the child died in 2006.
Yes.
And with the child's dying in 2006, it's viewed as if he lived with you for the whole year. So that will make you eligible both for the dependency exemption as well as the qualified widower status. So he's got that properly analyzed.
All right, let's take some more calls. Kathy in Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband and I prefer to have our withholding set such that we owe little or nothing once we get to April 15th.
Yes.
And he was fortunate enough to get a 10% raise for this year, for 2007. Is there a way we can calculate whether we're withholding enough to cover us with this new income?
What I might suggest you do is after you have your 2006 tax return done,
mm-hmm.
Look at your taxable income.
Okay.
And then go to the IRS package or get the tax rate schedule, and you'll see a marginal tax rate. For
okay.
example, let's say your taxable income was $65,000.
Okay.
All right. And your husband got a raise of $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go to the rate schedule and say the rate is 25%, all right?
Okay.
A $10,000 increase in salary times a 25% rate is I need to pay in another $2,500. And then compare your rate of withholding to what your liability was for 2006
okay.
to see if that's going to get you there. And then do the same thing on Wisconsin. On Wisconsin, you can use just a flat rate of, say, 6.75%, and that's going to get you close.
Oh, okay, great.
Now, if you itemize your deduction, the additional Wisconsin tax is deductible on the federal return, and if you're not subject to the alternative minimum tax, you could reduce the $2,500, in my example, by 25% of the additional Wisconsin tax.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Try it.
All right. Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate the call, and congratulations on the increasing salary. And Jim in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi.
My concern is about the 401k. Is there such a thing as a Roth-type 401k, and can you convert a regular 401k into a Roth-type, and over how many years, and what are the tax consequences?
All right. With respect to the Roth 401k, you have to be a participant in a 401k plan, plus the employer has to offer a Roth 401k feature in the 401k plan. And initially, many employers weren't really excited about offering the Roth because it was only temporary in the tax code, and in a couple of years, whatever it was, they would have to eliminate it. But the Roth 401k feature was made permanent, I believe, in the Pension Protection Act passed last summer. And therefore, it's more and more employers are offering it. But you have to be part of an employer 401k plan to do the Roth 401k. So I'd encourage you to check with your employer to see what all the options are that are available to you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. And Gina and Aaron, it's your turn now. Hi, Gina.
Hi. I have a question. My husband and I started a carpet cleaning business last year, and we used an accountant that it was the first time we had used this person for personal and business. And she was telling me that this year we needed to keep track of the chemicals, keep track of the inventory of chemicals that we use, and we would have to log the amount that we had at the beginning of the year and minus the amount that we had at the end of the year. And I guess I'm confused as to why. Is that correct? Why would you have to keep track of...
Yeah, your issue is whether what you have rises to the level of inventory or not, because you don't sell those chemicals.
Right. It's just used in our service for
yes,
cleaning.
And it's really more of a supply. And so you're using the cash method of accounting, I would assume?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're probably going to get different judgments on that, because if I buy supplies to use in my business, I'll usually, if I'm a cash method taxpayer, I'll expense those as I pay for them.
Okay.
And it sounds to me you have more of a supply type item than an inventory item.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Okay.
So you would disagree probably on this.
Yeah,
this
I would think so, yes.
Yeah, okay.
That was my feeling too. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Mary in Lodi, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is that my mother used to go to the library every week in Lodi, and now she was just diagnosed with cancer and is on hospice, and she has some HH bonds. And I vaguely remember reading somewhere you could donate to a charity. Just before she was diagnosed, we were talking about how we should give some money to the library. So then I read this, I vaguely remember reading this thing about giving bonds or giving something, bonds to charity or to a charity, and then you wouldn't have to pay the taxes or something, and you just give it to them and they get the bond and it's all over with. Is that true?
That sounds right, you know, but I've never had that question. I would think that would be right, because you haven't had a realization event, but I've never had that question. But I'm sure it'd be easy to find out by just looking it up. But
okay.
So if you just turn the bonds over, yeah.
Right.
You wouldn't cash them in and then turn that money over. You turn the bonds themselves over.
Right.
Give them the bond to the charity or to the library and then be done with it.
Yes.
And I don't have to worry about it. Because she was going to give money anyway to the library, and I just thought, why don't I? Because I vaguely remember reading that, and I thought, why don't I just give them a bond?
That sounds right, but I haven't addressed that issue that I can recall in my past, so I've not looked at it, so I can't speak with real authority.
Okay.
But it sounds reasonable. But just have it checked out, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the answer.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Mary. Charlene in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is almost like twofold or threefold. I got married about 3 years ago to my husband, and in the past, I've always paid to get my taxes done, and it's been done correctly with no questions from the IRS. Now, since we've been married, my husband also has paid to get his taxes done, and he's always claimed he has two other children on the outside, so he claims one of his kids, and then he claims his mother. Her birthday is in 1933. And so in 2005, when we claim his other son and his mother and then our two children that we have, the IRS wrote us a letter wondering about child income credit and why we're claiming, you know, her there as a dependent. And I think that was where the question came from. But I couldn't figure out if they were asking me just about the children or just about her being on there as a dependent, being that he's her sole supporter. You know, like we do give her money on a regular basis. She was living with us. She has moved back to Africa since then. But that was my question. And then
but she was now, with you in these years. What I would suggest you do is go to the, you know, first you need to understand what the IRS is asking, whether they're asking about his mother or some of your children. But
okay.
Then go to the IRS instructions where they list the like on the form 1040, 6C uh-huh. is a line for dependents.
Yes.
Then in the instructions for form 1040, there's probably 3, 4, 5 pages of kind of charts you walk through to determine whether an individual is eligible to be claimed as a dependent. So what I would do is just make copies of that and then go down and check, yes, we meet this one, yes, we meet that one, yes, we meet that one. We meet all the requirements, therefore, mom is eligible to be claimed as a dependent. Or if there's some you don't meet, then you'll understand why you don't meet a particular requirement. Mm-hmm. And if mom was claimed inappropriately, then, of course, you would admit that and the IRS will send you a bill for some tax due. But
okay.
That's probably the best way to do it, because to go through all that detail over the radio here would probably not be very interesting for many of our listeners. But
No.
Yeah. But that's what I would do.
My other question is that I'm trying to do my TurboTax now ourselves because of that reason.
Mm-hmm.
So do I need to figure this out before I do my TurboTax and file that? Because
well, I don't use TurboTax, but you know, in our tax system, we need to know whether a person is a dependent or not, because we make that judgment and put it in. TurboTax may have a series of questions that they'll run you through to get you that answer, but I don't know. I mean, I just never seen TurboTax. But so if your software doesn't determine that, then go to the IRS instructions again to walk through the various requirements to see if the individual is eligible to be claimed as a dependent.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Charlene. And Bob and Merrill, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
I'm retired on a civil service pension.
Yeah.
It's a disability. I just got a thing in the mail that said it will switch to an annuity. What difference does that make or not? It will be taxed as an annuity.
Well, an annuity usually is a similar dollar amount each year. It may increase, but then there are also rules if you have basis that you've made some non-deductible contributions, out-of-pocket contributions. If you have basis, then you need to determine what that basis is, and then you get to recover that and reduce the income that you pay tax on each year. So, and if the government won't report that for you, there's a worksheet in the IRS instructions that you can walk through to determine how much of your basis you should get back each year and not pay tax on. Also, the IRS, for a fee, if you give them the facts, they have a service that will actually calculate that for you.
The only thing being taken out of it now is federal tax and my life insurance premium.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
But, see, they oftentimes will provide some additional information to you discussing the taxation. Read through that and then see whether they're going to provide for you what you get back tax-free or whether it's a calculation you need to do yourself.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Bob. Deacon in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Doing a little bit of cleaning in the office and things like that. And how long do I have to keep either personal or business tax records? And how far back in year-wise can the IRS or anybody actually question what you've done so that you make sure you keep what's needed?
Yes. The general statute of limitations for federal is 3 years after the due date of filing the tax return. So for 2006, for example, you'd go to April 15th, 2007, you'd have 2010. Wisconsin is 1 year longer, so it'd be 2011. So to cover both federal and Wisconsin, I would just use 4 years for a safe period for retaining records from a tax perspective. There are other reasons that certain records you may need to keep more like 6 or 7 years, which is more of a legal issue than a tax issue. Certain documents you'll want to keep permanently, you know, like basis of buying property or stocks and things like that. Generally 3 years federal, four for Wisconsin.
But to be ultimately safe, if I just held everything for 7 years, I'd cover all the bases.
Yes, right, exactly. We'd cover probably many of the legal requirements as well.
And if they, you know, if they chose to go back in some of my past taxes, is that as far as they can go back if they ever, if that were to happen?
Yes. Usually they won't go back more than 3 or 4 years. However, both federal and Wisconsin has a six-year statute if there's a substantial omission from income, which is kind of 25%. If you've underreported by 25%, then a six-year statute of limitations can come into play. And then if tax fraud is involved, there is no statute of limitations. The year is always open.
They can just do whatever they want.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. And John in Waupun, your turn now. Hi, John.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a small business. Not a huge business, not very big at all, but I've never taken home office, and I can. But in taking home, my question, I guess, is on a Schedule C. Does home office, does it hit Schedule C, or does it come as a personal deduction?
If you use the home office in connection with your self-employed business, your Schedule C, what you do is you complete IRS Form 8829. That computes the home office deduction, and then from there it goes forward to Schedule C, and you claim the deduction on your Schedule C.
Because I'm trying to keep my income higher for credit purposes.
For what type of purposes?
Credit purposes.
Credit purposes.
You know, it's my debt-to-income ratio. Mm-hmm. That if I take it, then it's going to show less income. So probably the best thing is just not take it then, right?
You could choose not to take it. Sure. Mm-hmm. That's your choice. You know, I mean, when you figure self-employment tax at 15.3% plus federal and Wisconsin income tax, the tax burden on the self-employed goes up pretty quickly. So just make sure you're getting enough benefit from not claiming it.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you, John. Andrew in Oshkosh, hello to you.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the earned income credit. And for part of 2006, I spent it overseas and was not taxed. So when I actually looked at my W-2s, I have a small chunk for 2006 where I paid federal income tax. Is the earned income credit based on that, or should it reflect the fact that I still had an income threshold higher, which would then negate the earned income credit?
I just don't work with the earned income credit, so I can't help you out with that. There's probably 10, 12 pages in the IRS instructions would give you guidance. But in my client base, I just don't work with the earned income credit, so I'm not eligible or qualified to advise you on that.
Nope.
Just never deal
can't
with
help
it.
You out no. on that one. Sorry, Andrew. Frank in Madison, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hello. I have a question regarding the sale of a lake property, a vacant lot, and the capital gains tax. It's actually my father's the one who's selling it. He's over 65. His only income is from Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
The lot, when purchased back in the 60s, was $2,500, and now the selling price is $250,000.
All right.
So what is his capital gains tax, and is there any way to spread that out over several years or any way to reduce that?
Okay. If you would sell the property like on a land contract and get paid by the buyer over a number of years, you can use what's called installment reporting.
Okay.
You would take, you know, a land contract or a mortgage back from the buyer to protect your father's interest in the property security. If you do that, yes, you can use installment reporting, and you report the gain pro rata as you collect the principal. To do that, you use IRS Form 6252, and that walks you through the selling price, selling expenses basis to get the gain, and then it computes a gross profit ratio, which you use then to apply to your principal payments that you collect each year, and that's the amount that you pay gain on, the principal times your gross profit ratio. But if you don't do that, then you just have to report the gain all in the year of sale, and that may likely make some of your father's Social Security taxable. But the good news is you'll have a low tax rate. Federal to the extent you're in the less than the 25% bracket, that the 10 and 15% bracket, you actually pay a 5% rate on the capital gain, and then beyond that, it will be a 15% rate. Wisconsin only taxes 40% of long-term capital gains. So you should have a relatively low tax on that. You also might want to check the alternative minimum tax to see if that applies. If it doesn't apply, you may want to pay the Wisconsin tax in the year of sale to get the deduction on the federal return. If it does apply, you don't want to pay it because it's not going to save you anything. Just one other thing I might suggest, if your father was holding this for investment and not personal use, if you wanted to, you could do a deferred like-kind exchange. That is, if within 45 days of selling the lake lot, you identified replacement property and acquired like-kind real estate within 180 days thereafter, you could actually defer the gain into the replacement property, assuming you want to
do that.
Reinvest in real estate.
I see.
That's more of an investment decision. And that doesn't work for personal use property. It's got to be investment or rental property.
Right.
So you'd have to make sure that he was holding it for an investment purpose, and perhaps he was.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. And Kelly in Stevens Point, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question on the Wisconsin taxes. There's line 24 that says working families tax credit. I'd like to know who's entitled to take that, and do you have to have earned income for that? Or because somewhere I read you could be retired and get that.
Yes, basically that's available if you have limited income.
Yes.
I believe on a joint return you have to have less than like $19,000 of income.
Now, that's Wisconsin income, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And but I think it's income-based only. And there's a worksheet in the instructions that you work through to determine what your credit is. So if that line is less than $19,000, go through the worksheet in the instructions and see if you're entitled to some credit.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for calling. And Rebecca in Stoughton, hello.
Hi. I have my own personal IRA, and we also have a SEP IRA at work, and that gets contributed to if there's profits at the end of the year. Well, the last several years there was no profit, so I was wondering if I could deduct what I contribute to my personal one on my taxes.
Yes. If you check your W-2.
Okay.
And it will show whether there's an employer retirement plan coverage or not.
Okay.
If there is no employer coverage, you can make a deductible IRA contribution regardless of the amount of income you have.
Okay.
If there is employer coverage indicated, then you can only do deductible IRA contributions if you're within the gross income limitations. For example, if your income is less than $50,000 on a single return, you can do the maximum deduction, and it phases out over the next $10,000 of income. If you're married filing jointly, if the income is less than $75,000, you can do the full deductible IRA, and again, that phases out between $75,000 and $85,000 of income.
All right. Thank you very much, Rebecca. And Steve, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. You'll be back again, I hope.
Back in March.
Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. He'll be back in about a month, and we'll talk with him again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at understanding climate change in Wisconsin with Janine Richards of the Aldo Leopold Foundation in Baraboo. And then we'll also take a look at the rising popularity of farm tours in the state. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.